Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, what do you do to challenge yourself after you've won the Boston Marathon?
And the controversy over whether Chandler's mayor is eligible to be mayor.
But first, Mexico will hold precedent-setting elections this weekend, as voters will have the opportunity to elect over 800 judges. It's part of an effort by President Claudia Sheinbaum to make every judge in the country democratically elected by 2028. This is a radical restructuring of Mexico's judicial branch, and KJZZ's Nina Krivinsky has been covering it for us from the Hermosillo desk. Nina joins us now. Good morning, Nina.
Good morning, Sam.
So give us a little bit more context here. What exactly is happening on Sunday?
Yeah, so this is a super historic election. Like you said, across Mexico, more than 800 judge positions are going up for election. That's about half of the judges in the entire country. In 2027, the other half of the judicial branch will be up for election. And after that, every judge in Mexico will have been elected. It means that judges who have been in their seats for decades have to give up their jobs or run for office. And we're talking every judge, Sam, like from every member of the Supreme Court to low-level municipal, civil, sort of family court judges, even.
That is remarkable. How did we get to this point?
Yeah, so this is a result of a series of reforms to Mexico's constitution. They were orchestrated by the former president and formalized by the current president in Mexico. The previous president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, also known as AMLO in Mexico and around the world, regularly accused judges of impunity. He felt like they had too much power, and he would publicly call out judges that ruled against him while he was in office. And it's not so dissimilar kind of a rhetoric than we're seeing in the U.S. right now from the current president in the United States. And so this president in Mexico's the solution was to completely overhaul the justice system in Mexico. And we're seeing that commence with this election this weekend.
So by 2028, theoretically, as you were saying, all of the judges in Mexico would be democratically elected. Is mm-hmm. there any comparison for that elsewhere in the world?
No, it would make Mexico pretty unique. Virtually every country has the vast majority of their judges are appointed, go through a different process, aren't elected by the people. Obviously, in some states in the U.S., there are some state Supreme Court judges who
right.
are elected.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Mexico, this reimagining of the judiciary is pretty unique.
So you talked a little bit about the executive branch's perspective on this in Mexico. What do the Mexican people make of this?
Yeah, so, you know, people in Mexico agree that the criminal justice system has problems. Most crimes that happen in Mexico never even make it before a judge. And what Claudia Sheinbaum or the previous president, AMLO, would tell you is that this is going to root out problems like nepotism, favoritism in Mexico's judicial branch and make that branch more fair, accountable, trustworthy to the people. But, you know, there are many legal scholars and human rights advocates in Mexico and abroad who worry that this is a backsliding of democracy. You know, judges may be tempted to dole out the most politically popular ruling rather than the
right.
one they think is right.
Mm-hmm.
And they might be more influenced by outside pressures. That's a really big concern here. You know, that includes potentially drug cartels. You know, cartels have exerted influence, sometimes very violently in other elections. There's a chance that that could happen in these judicial elections, too.
Are we seeing any evidence of that?
Yeah, so you know, there are some candidates that have gotten a lot of press in that regard. The former lawyer for El Chapo, the notorious former leader of the Sinaloa cartel, is running. What you know, legal scholars would tell you is that defense attorneys represent all kinds of people, sometimes criminals. But you know, there are a lot of other candidates who are also making people concerned. Here in Sonora, where I am, south of Arizona, there are two candidates that have been flagged as high risk by this independent watchdog group called Defensores. One of those candidates was linked to the disappearance of a Sonoran journalist in 2005, but he was never investigated.
Well, so how is all of this resonating with voters themselves? What are you hearing from the people you've spoken to?
Yeah, so I went out in Hermosillo to just ask people on the street what they thought about the election and whether they were going to vote. Most, Sam, were frankly overwhelmed by the number of candidates that are up for election here. People in Hermosillo have to decide between more than 80 people running for the many different judge positions that are up for election here. A few people told me that they know some of the candidates, but not all of them. Remember, there are more than 80. But these candidates, you know, due to restrictions on campaigns, just haven't had the chance to really get their names or faces out there very much. So a lot of people want to vote, but they don't have time to do all that research. That's part of the reason that turnout is expected to be pretty low, under 20%, according to the federal body that runs elections. And some of the people that I talk to worry that the political party that's in power, you know, President Sheinbaum's party, in the executive and legislative branches have this outside influence in picking and approving judicial candidates. That's a really big concern here. And all of this has led observers to wonder, you know, whether this is really the show of democracy that proponents say it's going to be, or if it's more of a way for that political party to exert control over the judicial branch.
All right. Well, it'll be fascinating to see how this plays out this weekend, in particular, those turnout numbers. That is KJZZ's Nina Krivinsky reporting from Hermosillo. Nina, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Sam.
The mayor of Chandler is facing questions about whether he is legally allowed to be serving in that office. Kevin Hartke was appointed to the city council in 2008 and then won two elections to the council in 2010 and 2014. At the end of that term in 2018, he ran for and was elected mayor. He was reelected to that job in 2022. But a provision in the city charter has led some to wonder if he was eligible to run for mayor in the first place. His 2022 opponent has filed a complaint, and his colleagues on the council are debating whether to change the language in the city charter as a result of this controversy. With me to talk about what the legal issues are here is attorney Andy Gayona, a partner with the Phoenix firm of Coppersmith Brockelman. He's an election, political, and public law attorney, although he is not involved in this case. So, Andy, what does Chandler's charter actually say about who is and who is not eligible to hold office?
Sure. So the Chandler City Charter says that no person shall be eligible to be elected to the office of council member for more than two consecutive terms, or the office of mayor for more than two consecutive terms, or to more than a consecutive combination of same. Sentence one. Sentence two. A person elected to two consecutive terms as a council member, or two consecutive terms as a mayor, or a combination of same as set forth. Shall not be eligible to hold either office again until 4 years have elapsed.
So you need a break in between.
Correct.
So do you read that to suggest that the current mayor of Chandler should not be the mayor of Chandler?
You know, Mark, in my practice, I litigate a lot of really complicated statutory construction questions, constitutional issues, and a lot of times the text is ambiguous and we're struggling here. To me, this text seems relatively clear. That the current mayor is probably not eligible to currently hold his office.
And presumably then, if that is your belief, then the previous mayors who would also fall into this category also probably should not have been there?
That's right. And, you know, you're getting to what the city has said as to why Mayor Hartke may be able to serve in office and why this may be ambiguous, which is, well, we've always done it this way. The problem is when you're interpreting statutes and constitutions and city charters, which function like the constitution of a city— That's not a very good argument when the text is plain. And our courts, in particular our current Supreme Court, have said, we're going to stop our analysis if the text is clear and it provides a clear answer to the question. And to me, again, this text is pretty clear.
Well, so why do you think it is? And this might be a little bit of speculation, but like this is in the city charter. Presumably it's been there for more than just, you know, the last couple of weeks. Why has nobody seen this or thought to look at this before?
That's an excellent question, one I'm not capable of answering. This is certainly something that could have been brought up, for example, when Mayor Hartke filed his nomination petitions. Someone could have filed a lawsuit at that point saying, you can't be on the ballot because you are not eligible to be on the ballot. Someone could have brought this up, his opponent, Ruth Jones, in the 2022 election, could have brought this up in an election contest that has to be filed right after the election is canvassed. It didn't get brought up then, and it's only being brought up now. And, you know, it's a good question about why no one thought of this earlier.
So you mentioned Ruth Jones, Mayor Harkey's opponent in the last election. She has filed a complaint. Meanwhile, the city council is looking at asking voters to change this provision. Is it that simple just to make it okay, assuming that the council puts it on the ballot and voters approve it?
It's not that simple. I haven't seen either the complaint that was filed, and I haven't studied the proposed amendment to the charter in any level of detail. It's possible it could cure the problem going forward, but the question is, what do we do now? And what do we do about everything that's happened since the mayor was elected in 2022, which I think are a lot of the questions that people are raising right now in the city as they try to figure out a path forward, having received this legal opinion that they have, that the mayor may not be able to be there.
So what are some of the options? Because the mayor has obviously taken a lot of votes since he was elected. So like what happens to all of that?
The good news for Chandler and its city operations, I suppose, is that in Arizona, we have something called the de facto officer doctrine that says that if you are serving in a public office and it's later determined that you were not eligible for that office, you weren't supposed to be there, that the law in most cases is going to presume that the acts that you took were valid and is not going to let someone come in and say, for example, all of the votes that Mayor Hartke took from 2022 to the point at which he resigns or is removed or is not elected for yet another term were invalid. So that may not apply to everything he did, but for most things, that de facto officer doctrine should give the city legal cover.
So in theory, then, any policies that have been enacted or votes have taken would stand, generally speaking, even if it's determined that he shouldn't have been taking those votes.
That's correct. And we have that because we want – the law favors continuity in government, and it doesn't favor the chaos that might happen, for example, if everything that Mayor Hartke voted on over the past several years was overturned, every rezoning case, every liquor license. You can see how if we were to say that all of that was invalid, it would – cause the city of Chandler, you know, a whole lot of trouble. So we have that doctrine so that we don't end up in that situation.
Is there precedent for this in Arizona?
There is. Several years ago, a gentleman named Tony West was elected to the Arizona Corporation Commission. He was sworn into office, began to serve, and it was discovered somewhere along the line that he actually wasn't qualified to be a corporation commissioner. He had some sort of securities dealer registration that disqualified him from holding that office. And there was what's called a quo warranto action filed against him by Renz Jennings, who was the incumbent who Tony West had defeated. And ultimately, the Arizona Supreme Court agreed that Tony West was not eligible to hold office. It ousted Mr. West from office, and it said that Renz Jennings, as the incumbent, should be reinstated as a holdover, as it's known under the law, to finish out whatever was left of that term until that the Office of Corporation Commissioner was filled, that vacancy, rather, was filled under Arizona law.
So from a practical, logistical standpoint, the next mayoral election in Chandler will be next year. What are the steps that have to happen between now or that could happen between now and then? Like what kinds of actions could we potentially see?
So option one is the county attorney here files a quo warranto action against Mayor Hartke saying you are not eligible to hold this office and a court needs to remove you. If Ms. Jones or somebody else who claims they have a right to that office were to ask the county attorney to file such an action and they don't do so, that individual may have standing to file an action on their own in court. So that's step one. The other one is that there's a provision under the city charter actually where a member of the city council, rather, or the mayor can forfeit their office.
Mm.
And it says that you can forfeit your office if you lack any qualification or if you violate any express provision of the charter. If the city council wanted to, they could institute forfeiture proceedings against Mayor Hartke. He's got due process rights to a hearing and such if they were to do that. But in either case, if that were successful, if a quo warranto action were successful, there would be a vacancy in the office of the mayor. And under the city charter, the remaining members of the city council would have to fill that within 30 days by appointment. Or if they don't do so within 30 days, call a special election that has to be held no more than 120 days after the vacancy occurs.
Do you think it's safe to say that there are people in charter cities across the state scouring them to see if there are similar provisions to this and that if anybody who's currently serving in office or maybe has in the recent past has violated it?
I would think so. I think those legal departments and their outside counsel are you know, looking at all those documents to see what they say. Because what we saw in Chandler, for example, is everybody sort of being surprised once it was brought to their attention that this was even a remote possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of people may have assumptions about what things say, and then you read them again, you know, fresh eyes and whatnot, and realize that, you know, we may have a problem here.
That is Andy Gayona, a partner at Coppersmith Brockelman. Andy, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, two-time Olympian Des Linden first started running marathons as a challenge to herself.
This isn't a limit of what's possible for me to do, but what can I achieve here? So that was intriguing to me.
Now, after becoming the first American woman to win the Boston Marathon in 3 decades, she says marathons aren't enough of a challenge.
But first, if you are a sports fan, you've probably noticed the rapid expansion of gambling apps. Companies like FanDuel, MGM, DraftKings, even legacy media companies like ESPN are all making it remarkably easy to place bets on everything from what'll happen during a single at-bat in a D-backs game to who will end up as the WNBA's most valuable player. There is nothing new about gambling, of course, but legal sports betting is a very recent phenomenon. It's making a lot of companies very rich, very quickly, and convincing a lot of first-time gamblers that they, too, are going to get very rich. This is a trend that worries Jonathan Cohen, the author of a new book on the subject called Losing Big: America's Reckless Bet on Sports Gambling. I spoke with Cohen recently, and he told me that while the legalized gambling explosion may seem sudden, it's actually a moment we've been building towards for decades.
Over the course of the late 20th century, we saw a gradual liberalization of American gambling laws, starting with the legalization of charity bingo, then lotteries, then tribal casinos, then non-tribal casinos, and then daily fantasy sports, and now sports betting. So sports gambling, it was in fact, you know, a long part of American history and a long part of American sports, and sort of appeared to be on a slow trajectory towards legalization. Congress, with the cooperation of the sports leagues, put a damper on that in 1992 with the passage of the Professional Amateur Sports Protection Act that blocked states from legalizing sports gambling. And in 2018, the Supreme Court overturned that law, effectively permitting states to legalize sports gambling if they wanted to.
Right. And since that decision was overturned, 38 states, as of this recording, have gone ahead and legalized sports gambling. And the numbers, to my mind, are pretty staggering. The estimate is that 20 to 40% of Americans have placed at least one bet on sports since 2018. I mean, did that bowl you over as much as it did me?
Yeah, and I'll say that number is who have bet on sports legally, not to mention, which is important because Texas and California don't have legal sports betting yet. But eventually, those two states are going to legalize, and the size of the market is effectively going to double.
My goodness. I mean, these are just staggering numbers to think about. Have you gambled on sports yourself?
Yes, I did before the 2018 Supreme Court decision, and I have somewhat recently.
Okay. Would you be able to say personally, like, what is it about sports gambling that you like?
I would say for me personally, sports was a big part of my youth, and specifically sports fandom. And, you know, as I've gotten older, you know, the edges of my fandom have sort of receded, and my fervor for sports have sort of receded. And as my wife, who's not even a sports fan, can attest, it is so easy to put $5 on a game, to put 10 cents on a game, and immediately the stakes of that game that you have no control over, it's taking place in Houston between two basketball teams. You don't even know any of the players' names or anything. The stakes of that game could not feel higher.
Yeah.
Could not feel more consequential
right.
when you literally have 10 cents on the line. So I think as a matter of just excitement, sports betting in that way can be fun and should be generally permissible.
Okay. Okay. So let's get then to why for you this is potentially a crisis.
There is mounting evidence that sort of what I initially suspected and what drove me to write the book in the first place is sort of now being verified through research, which is that in states that have legalized online sports betting, the rates of bankruptcy, rates of credit card delinquencies, reduced savings and investment in the stock market, particularly in low-income households, not to mention indicators, and it's notoriously hard to track, but indicators that rates of problem gambling or gambling addiction, or even sort of a lesser version of it, sort of problematic play, hazardous play, that rates of all of those have been increasing, particularly among young men. This is not just a benign new gambling activity, but this is a mounting public health crisis.
And how is problem gambling, dangerous gambling, defined?
The American Psychiatric Association has a list of 10 behaviors, I guess, and a certain exhibiting a certain number of those behaviors within a certain time period is evidence that you have, you are either at risk for a gambling addiction or you have a gambling addiction. The most common one that I'm guilty of doing is chasing your losses. Mm-hmm. If you lose a bet and you feel like you have to double down or you have to place another bet to try to get back what you just lost.
Right.
But they range to much more severe, from thinking about gambling all the time to lying to friends and family or therapists about the extent of one's gambling to committing a crime in service of gambling or in service of getting money for gambling.
Yeah. Well, so speaking of like the diagnostic environment around this, something I was thinking about, and I wonder if you could speak to this at all, is that there are other things that are legal in American life that are addictive. Alcohol, certain painkiller medications, like these things are legal, but they're also addictive. Gambling, also legal, also potentially addictive, but notably not a substance. It's almost like it's more of like a psychosis.
Yeah. So this is, what you're referring to is actually something that's very unique about gambling,
uh-huh.
which is that it is the only behavioral addiction categorized as such by the American Psychiatric Association. Unlike, you might think of, kleptomania or sex addiction. Those are sort of often referred to as addictions, but are not mm-hmm. actually formally categorized as like technical addictions.
Uh-huh.
Gambling addiction is categorized that way because of the recognition that when you are addicted to gambling, that addiction rewires your brain, affects your brain chemistry as if you were taking drugs. Because people are going to get addicted to it, by increasing the number of people who have access to it, you are, by definition, going to increase the number of people who are addicted.
Yeah. So what are some solutions you might suggest to moderate this a little bit, put some backstops in place?
So in the book, I have all sorts of policy ideas for things to fix sports gambling. Deposit limits, how much you can deposit within a certain amount of time, affordability checks to prove players who are gambling a lot of money can afford what they're actually playing, limiting advertising, all sorts of other things that either the sports books could put in place themselves, or if they're not going to, and spoiler alert, they never will, states could regulate and could require them mm-hmm. To change about their behavior. But there are all these new companies coming out that are probably never going to be required to follow any policy of any kind. So what's even the point of gambling regulation? Of course, I think it's valuable and I think it should happen. But until regulators figure out what to do about those companies, I'm fearful that regulation might only go after the good faith actors when there are still so many bad faith actors out there. I do think that there are actual solutions that are that should happen regardless of public policy and sort of the shape of regulations. And these would be sort of on the cultural side and on the attitudinal side. I for example, I think this current generation of young men was basically caught flat-footed, and their teachers and their parents and the like were caught flat-footed by the rise of sports gambling and how quickly it has taken over these young men's finances and their mental health. And we know how addictive it is now. We know how these apps are designed, and we could better prepare younger generations to deal with gambling as adults, and we could destigmatize gambling addiction, and we could normalize calling for help when they need help. These are things I think that should happen that would help acclimate a new generation to the new normal. And the new normal is gambling on your phone at all times.
Well, Jonathan Cohen is the author of Losing Big, America's Reckless Bet on Sports Gambling. Jonathan, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks, Sam.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. The Trump administration has canceled more than 1,400 National Science Foundation grants worth more than $1 billion, according to USA Today. Many of these grants were terminated because they were labeled by the Department of Government Efficiency as, quote, wasteful DEI funding. My next guest is one of those scientists whose grant was abruptly ended by the Trump administration. Liliana Kaufman is an assistant professor and senior global future scientist at ASU and works mostly in the areas of indigenous studies and sustainability. She was one of the principal investigators on an NSF grant worth nearly $1.5 million called Weaving Relations that focused on graduate-level education specifically for indigenous and Latine students. Those researchers focused on areas including food sovereignty and traditional ecological knowledge. Kaufman came by the studio recently to talk about her experience and what may come next, and she wanted to stress that the opinions she expressed are hers and not those of ASU. We started our conversation by talking about what the point of the program was beyond the actual research students were doing. What was the goal?
Yeah, there are a few goals. One of them was to offer new pathways into STEM, where these students who, like I said, come from many different disciplines would have the opportunity to see themselves as scientists, see themselves as researchers, and do it in a way that was related to their cultural and community identities. So we were trying to also study this as a approach that could be used to help Indigenous and Hispanic, Latine grad students be more confident and be able to be successful if they wanted to continue on in that kind of career, or the master's students, which we had many of, if they wanted to go get their PhDs, and then ultimately see what worked and what didn't, share that with others, and hopefully have more science identity in these folks so they could go back to their communities and take on important roles that require more skills and education.
Hmm. So how did you find out that your funding and this program were being eliminated?
It was a little traumatic. We weren't necessarily surprised, but the way it came in was surprising. So we knew that when the Trump administration took power, that they were not interested in a lot of, you know, quote, DEI-related work and research. And so we saw some stop work orders come through that, like, didn't necessarily directly apply to us, but gave us some pause. But we were instructed to keep doing the work we were doing. And then about 2 weeks ago, on a Friday afternoon at 3 p.m., there was just a blanket email that went out to about 50 grants throughout the country. And we were actually in the very first wave of terminations.
What else did the email say?
It said that it said our grant, and it said that it's no longer in alignment with National Science Foundation priorities. And then there were a few requests they had, just kind of the typical things that happen when a grant ends naturally that they wanted us to do immediately. And the funds stopped flowing immediately. So we had to fire people. People lost salaries. We had to cancel all of our plans for this summer. So it was very fast and very complete.
How many people did you have to let go?
Well, there were probably 3 to 4 graduate students who were in positions that were that functioned more like a staff position. And yeah, those were the ones that's their livelihood and it pays their tuition. So those ones were the hardest and they had to go immediately. Fortunately, we've rehomed many of them. So they're with other research or positions on campus. And then there's like the theoretical number of students that we kind of let go, but some of their work hadn't started yet, but they were relying on it. So
maybe 30 students affected by that at that point.
You mentioned that this wasn't necessarily a surprise to you. Was there anything that you could do to try to get ahead of it or plan for these kinds of changes before you got that email?
Yeah, we had been planning for it in some sense since November.
Since the election.
Yes, yes. And we had some contingency plans, but it was challenging because when we reached out to the program officers at NSF, they never responded. So we really didn't know where we stood. And also, the administration at ASU had been saying, keep going until you're forced to stop. So we had to sort of simultaneously have these background plans while also doing the same level of work. And it was a little more surprising than I think it would have been if we hadn't just the day or two before been meeting with administration at ASU to plan our whole budget for the following year.
Hmm.
So it was seeming a little bit more positive, and then it was just completely shut down.
What was that like? Like when you had to tell people that they were out of a job and, you know, tell people who were hoping to do this program that the program no longer existed?
It was really hard and really sad. We, as the leadership, were grieving and couldn't really let ourselves feel those feelings because the students are our highest priority. And our students come from so many different backgrounds. They are adults. They have lives. Some have, have dependents, have kids, other family. And we've been working with many of these students for years. So that was really hard because we really do try and be strong mentors and advocates for them. And we really had very few tools to support them or ourselves through it.
So is there any hope of being able to bring this program back, or is that just it?
Well, I always have hope. Some foundations are offering bridge funding to people who have had their grants terminated, and so we will be applying for that. Unfortunately, we probably had $600,000 left or something like that, and these bridge funding grants are up to $25,000.
So not really close to what you had lost.
No, definitely not.
What has it been like for you? I mean, you mentioned that you in some ways weren't really able to fully process what happened because you had to make sure that the students were okay and had someone to talk to. Like, what have these last few weeks been like for you?
It's truly been just a blur. It's made me feel like the work I do doesn't matter. And it's made me concerned for my position within the university, although they at the university administration level say that we're all safe. And I do believe that. I'm more thinking about being attacked for the types of work that I do around diversity in science, around working with indigenous communities, around climate change or other types of environmental harms and healing. So, yeah, it's just sort of scary. And I feel a little bit like I'm just on unstable ground and I don't know what to do next.
Yeah. What does it mean for science that your project will not be able to continue?
I was thinking about this yesterday, actually. It's hard to know the impacts, but I think for these tribal communities that a lot of these students come from, it can have a really big impact on their ability to self-govern and to have people from their own communities be in science-based roles, which is a real problem and something we were trying to help solve. And then for the greater, societal well-being and status of science, I would say we need people from all different backgrounds to see themselves as scientists, have experiences with research, have experiences working with community and bridging all those gaps. And we need to know how to train people. So we were studying how to do that better, and now we are going to be behind in that area of research and practice.
Do you still believe in the National Science Foundation?
That's a good question. I do, because It has a long history, and there has not yet been any thought about getting rid of it entirely. So I think the United States needs to continue being ahead and at least caught up internationally with science. So I think I believe in it. I just don't know what it really is anymore right now.
All right, Liliana, thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was wonderful to speak with you.
Liliana Kaufman is an assistant professor and senior global future scientist at ASU. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. It is hard to imagine a more illustrious running career than Des Linden's. The 41-year-old ASU alum is a winner of the Boston Marathon and has been an Olympian twice. So the pro running world was shocked earlier this year when, just before the most recent Boston Marathon, Linden announced her retirement from professional marathon racing. But while that chapter of her career may be over, a new one is just beginning. When I spoke to Linden recently, she told me that this is a change she's been pondering for some time.
It's definitely something that's kind of been on my mind for a while. Like, how long can you stay at a professional career in sports and at a high level and, you know, feel like you're giving it everything and not really taking it for granted?
I could imagine someone hearing you say that and imagining that you're talking about, you know, the excitement, the privileges that come with being a pro athlete. Maybe you are talking about those things, but from reading some stuff about you, I also get the sense that you want to be kind of challenged and pushed, and that maybe you had reached a point where competitive marathoning felt a little too familiar. Is that fair to say?
That's very accurate. Yeah. Just the last few years, it's felt like I've been going through the motions, and part of it is that I've been in the career for a long time. But also I was very fortunate to accomplish a lot of the big goals that I had set for myself. I made two Olympic teams, won the Boston Marathon. So then it was kind of hard to, you know, keep attacking in the same way and have the same excitement and the same energy about it.
What drew you to marathoning originally? I know you in college ran primarily the 1500 and the 5K. What made you want to jump up to the marathon level?
It was just pure envy. I ran with a group of runners, and I hated the longer distances, and they trained for a marathon, went and competed. And, you know, we all started the day as runners. And by the end of the day, they ran 26.2 across the finish line, and they were marathoners. And I was like, oh, now they have something I don't have.
Yeah.
It seemed like a thinking person's sport.
Talk a little bit about that thinking. Because one of the things I've heard you talk about in other interviews is how much of marathoning is fatigue management and pain management.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the things that drew me to it. You have to look at the whole 26.2 miles and be very calculated in how you're going to use your energy, where you're going to push, where you're going to race, where you're going to respond.
Could I ask you to, just as an example of what you're talking about, let's go with the Boston Marathon course as an example. Can you just give us a little sampling of when you think about that course and how to navigate those specific 26.2 miles?
Yeah, the Boston course is so unique and special in that way. The first 6 miles, you're just going to bomb downhill and you think you're having the day of your life, but you're just hammering your quads, and you remember that, like, don't go out too hard. You have to conserve a lot for the last 6 miles, which is a strange thing to be thinking about 2 hours ahead of time. Then you have the middle sections where you're managing the pack. Are they going to make moves? Is this real? Are we too far out? Is this pace too quick? And then the big thing with the Boston Marathon course is, you know, before the 17-mile mark, you get your first, like, nice climb of the day. And that's really, it sounds kind of funny, it's around 15 or 16 miles, but that's the first real challenge of the day. Mm-hmm. And then you're set up with a series of these 4 challenging hills, and like, you got to match what the group's doing, but also manage your energy, attack the hills, use the downhills. You know, and so the kind of the saying with the marathon is you run the first 20 miles with your head being very strategic and savvy, and then you run the last 6.2 with your heart.
That makes me think of another thing I read that you said somewhere about how part of the appeal for running for you from when you first started doing it was this idea of figuring out where your limits are, knowing what you're capable of. Do you feel like when you discovered marathoning, it felt like the outer limits of those capabilities?
Yeah, I think it. You go into that first one and it's so unknown and you can't cover the distance in training because then you would just beat your body up too much. And so you go in wondering if you have what it takes. So getting the first one under my belt was kind of scratching the surface of like, okay, this isn't a limit of what's possible for me to do, but what can I achieve here? And so that was intriguing to me. And I feel like that's as I got to the end of the career as well, that mystery was sort of gone. Like, I feel like I saw what I could do and found out how good I was in this distance. And now I'm curious about other things.
Yeah. Though, of course, I don't want to go by the fact that what initially drew you to marathons was, as you put it, pure envy. And you are somebody who is also very honest about the fact that it's about winning. So where are you going to get that from now that you're retiring from pro marathoning?
Yeah, it's a really great point. And I think that's the challenge for professional athletes is we turn the page. The competition and the workouts and things like that, that's come easy to me. I like that the most, but I've taught myself to enjoy going out and appreciate the run for the sake of the run. So I'm fortunate that I'll have that moving forward. I see myself as a lifelong runner. But that competition void, I think I've said I've retired from professional marathoning in order to leave the door open for some longer races, ultras, and I think that'll have to scratch the competitive itch for me.
So I just want to make sure people don't let that go by too fast. This is, one of the most accomplished American marathon runners saying that you're retiring from pro marathoning because the marathons aren't long enough.
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's, again, going into that unknown. Like, I do have a 50-miler on my radar that I'm intrigued by, and it's sort of that initial thing with the marathon. It's like, this distance seems kind of crazy. And then people will ask, like, what about a 100-miler? I'm like, absolutely not, never. But I've learned to never say never because right. That means it'll probably happen.
That's what you said about the marathon.
Exactly. And so I don't even doubt it anymore. But yeah, I think it's a little bit of that unknown and just getting to a start line with some nerves and some, doubts in my mind of what it's going to feel like after 30 miles and things like that. I that's fun. That's the fun stuff about racing. And it's what was missing with the marathon at this point in my career.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, can I ask you about that headspace of the unknown? Because as we've been talking about, the marathons had become sort of rote for you. And I hear you saying that part of the appeal of something like an ultra is you don't really know how your body's going to respond to that challenge. And that's part of what you're looking to discover.
It's trusting the training, which I've done my whole career. You just don't know what's going to happen after 30. But if you've done a lot of work, it's a little bit easier to buy into being excited about the unknown versus just being terrified.
Yeah. I'm sure somebody has tipped you off about the Coca-Dona. Which we
yes.
talked about on the show here a while back. That one is, if I'm not mistaken, 250 miles. Does that hold any appeal for you?
See, this is the problem because it's the like, as soon as I say no, I'll be there next year, there's a few steps prior. I think, and actually Arizona is just great. There's Black Canyons, Javelina 100, Cocodono. There's so many opportunities to race out there. And I think I'll have to take the stepping stones of, 50K, 50 miler, 100 miler. And then, if I'm still into it, 250 is out there. And that would probably be the place to do it.
All right. Well, Des Linden is a former professional marathon runner and future ultra marathon runner. Des, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
How long do you think it would take you to run 50 miles?
I'm going to say conservatively a week. there's a part in that conversation where Des talks about having the thought, am I running too fast? And I thought, that's not a thought I've ever had.
Yeah, no, that's not a concern I would need to share. Yeah. And but also kind of counterintuitive, like as you're running a race, to be thinking, because obviously the goal is to win and to right. run faster than anybody else, kind of counterintuitive to be thinking, am I doing this too quickly?
Yeah. My goal when I am running is to feel good about eating buffalo wings afterwards.
I think that's reasonable.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. It's gotten me this far.
All right. Well, that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Anna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Chad Snow, our news director. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Thanks again for being here. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.